thanks everyone for coming. So this is really exciting for me. I have my light on. First of all, it's always great. Hey, Hank, great to see you. Just pull in a chair.
There is a chair right between Kirsten.
Oh, yeah. There's a chair between Robin and Kirsten. I'll move in. Yeah, this is good. It feels full. All right, thank you so much, everyone, for coming. I'm really excited to be here. I started my day at 5:45 on the East Coast, so I'll try to stay up. Just came back today, specifically to be here. So thank you all for being here also. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah, I just had coffee. So we'll see how I'm doing after this tonight. There's a lot that I want to cover, and I'll just tell you where this kind of came together. I'm really excited about this whole four-part series, and we've revamped the way we're going to try to teach during the year for adult education here at Beth Jacob. So we're doing shorter stints of like series that we're going to go through together. And hey, Tibby, great to see you. So my inspiration for this whole four-part series actually started with some learning I did while in Italy this summer. I decided to take one book with me that I thought was going to be practical and to be motivated to keep up with my learning. And so I took the section of Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, that focuses on the laws of what we refer to as Bishul Akum, or Gentile cooking. And the reason that I took that is because we have this kind of plan to try to reach out to vegan restaurants in the area and see if they would go under my supervision to be certified as kosher. And so I figured before I actually go through and try to reach out to other restaurants, may as well like refresh some of the laws for myself as well. So I started this process, and I actually spent 3 or 4 weeks going through these laws very part-time in Italy, and then while on vacation, back with Meir's family in New York, and back when I came here, I remember studying it on the train from Florence to Venice, because you go through a bunch of tunnels and there's not much to look at, which is actually the opposite of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says that if you're going on your way and you're studying Torah, you shouldn't interrupt your Torah to say, how beautiful is this tree? So I actually did the opposite. When I couldn't look at the trees, I studied Torah, which is, it is what it is. Better to learn than not to learn at all. But I went through these laws, and they're very detailed and specific, and I realized that there's kind of two currents within these halachot, within these laws. And but the more I thought about it, the more I thought that these two different currents are intentional. There's a current of stringency, of really kind of pushing the limits of how secluded the Jewish people can be by their food laws. And then there's kind of a subcurrent within that of, well, if you do it this way, maybe it's okay, or if you do it that way, it's okay. And so I was trying to figure out, like, what is going on here within the halacha? What's the intent of these laws? First of all, to kind of map out a lot of what we're going to study tonight, most of these laws are not biblical in nature. The laws that we're going to zoom in on tonight. We're not going to talk, for the most part, about the laws of kosher, of what animals are kosher, and milk and meat, and how to check for bugs. That's not tonight's main topic. Tonight's main topic is this series of rabbinic laws that are generally referred to as the foods of Gentiles, ma'chalei akum, or if you're going to translate it really literally, the foods of those who worship idols. That's akum is an acronym for ovdei kochavim u'mazalot, those who worship idols and stars. So there's this kind of body of rabbinic law that goes beyond the Torah's laws of kosher and adds to them. And I wanted to figure out, why are they there in the first place? What are the reasons for the loopholes within them? Because we're going to see there are many loopholes within them. I'm going to take off my sweater while we get started. Most recently, the past week, I spent in New York talking to future rabbis and current rabbis, and I spoke to some of them. Did anyone know the historical context of these laws? And I did a little bit of research in terms of that as well. And then finally, I have a theory, a kind of a philosophy of what's going on under the surface here. And I want to share it with you. And I'm excited that it's kind of the culmination of 6 months of my own learning and thinking. And if you like it, great. And if not, let's get started. So before we get to these rabbinic laws, which are 2,000 years old, we'll go to the really old stuff and talk about the first laws in the Torah itself. What are the first prohibitions laid out before Adam and Eve?
Not to eat from the tree.
So that's what I thought. That if you're a Genesis 2 kind of person, then it's to not eat from the tree.
Just to eat only the vegetation.
Great. Great. So if you go back to the first chapter of Bereishit, parenthetically, those who've read Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith, he has a beautiful essay basically pointing out that Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 are two parallel stories of creation. And so his approach is that they're teaching us two different messages about the purpose of humanity. And without going that into that in great detail, it's only in Genesis 2, chapter 2, that we're told, do not eat from the tree. And that's in source 2 here. You can read it for yourselves later. Don't eat from the tree, or of every tree in the garden you are free to eat. But as for the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you must not eat of it. So mitzvah number 2 in the Torah is don't eat of the tree of knowledge. Eitz hadaat tovara. Mitzvah number 1 is actually in source 1 here in the first chapter, and chronologically this may or may not have come first. God says that I have given you every seed-bearing plant that is upon all the earth. This is God speaking to man during day 6 of creation, right after man is created. This is what God says. The very next verses are, and God saw that it was very good. It was day, it was night, or it was night, it was day, the sixth day. So this is right before Shabbat in Genesis 1. So the Torah says, God said, see, I give you every seed-bearing plant that is upon all the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit, they shall be yours for food. And to all the animals on the land, and to all the birds of the sky, and to everything that creeps on earth, in which there is the breath of life, I give all the green plants for food, and it was so. So, what did God just say? Yeah. Well, did he say it or did he not say it? Terry whispered, be a vegetarian. Did he say that?
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what I hear.
This should be your food. It's not saying don't eat. It's more like positive. Right. Eat this stuff.
Right. You hear it between the lines of what you should be doing.
Right.
You should be eating all of the grass of the field and all of the fruits of the tree. It doesn't say don't eat from the tree of knowledge until the next chapter. Just interesting to point that out. And it doesn't say you can eat animals.
It doesn't say you can't.
It doesn't say explicitly you can't. However, if you then go to source 3, source 3 is jumping 9 chapters ahead in Bereishit. This is the story of Noah right after the flood. So Noah leaves the ark and creates an offering for God. And it's then God comes to him in a dream. And anyone remember what's the famous sign that God gives to Noah? It's the rainbow. And God communicates to Noah. And God tells him, anyone want to read source 3 for us?
Every creature that lives shall be yours to eat. As with the green grasses, I give you all these. You must not, however, eat flesh with its lifeblood in it.
Okay. So, let's divide this verse into two different commandments, or two different statements. We'll get there. Okay, we're heading in your direction, Cindy. Statement number 1 is, that stuff that I told you can eat before, now you can add some extra things to the list. You used to only be able to eat greenery, vegetation. Now you can also eat the animals. So why is that? Is that God's initial intent? Is this only God saying, well, now that I realize that humanity can't really keep up with my high expectations, I'm going to lower them? Rav Kook parenthetically felt that the ideal of God in creating the world was the hope that everyone would be a vegetarian. Maybe we can't live up to that hope. Other people read it differently and say, no, the fact that God commands us later in the Torah to bring offerings of animals is a clear sign that God has no intent for us to be vegetarians. Today's not a class about vegetarianism. We can talk about that another time. But I think it's really interesting. I knew these laws, but it had never been framed for me this way. That before the Torah starts talking about before the Torah tells us to keep Shabbat, right? God keeps Shabbat. But before the Torah tells us to keep Shabbat, the Torah very much tells humanity what to eat and what not to eat. Right? You can eat first vegetation, not animals, then you can eat animals. And to Tzipi's point, what's the second part of this verse talking about? The Hebrew is always helpful, I mean, even though the Hebrew is confusing on its own. Ach basar benafsho, however, flesh with its soul, damo lo tochelu, its blood you should not eat. It's hard to parse out that phrase there in Hebrew and in English. Rashi says that this is the commandment, the negative commandment that is given to all Noahides. It's one of the 7 Noahide laws, the 7 laws that apply from the Torah's view to all of humanity, not to eat Eiver Minachai, a limb from a living animal. Do not eat a limb from a living animal. apparently that may have been a practice that was done in some pagan societies. For whatever case, before we get to any actual particular mitzvah of the Torah, first, certainly before we get to anything that has to do between Jew and Gentile, the Torah lays out a number of dietary laws to all of humanity. Right? You can now eat meat, but you have to be careful about how you eat meat. It can't be all meat. It has to be meat that has been killed in some way. It can't be a lot. It can't be living meat. So the whole kind of take the lobster and boil it while it's, you know, boil it in order to eat it, that's not probably kosher according to the Torah, even for all people. That might be a form of Eber Minachai, of eating something without having been killed first. Or at the very least, it's Tsar Baal Chaim. It's definitely cruelty to animals, I would think. But that's just my opinion. You shouldn't eat lobster anyways. So before we move into the particular, the Torah has kind of laid out a number of universal laws. What I think is really interesting is once we get into, hey guys, come on in. Do we have some more chairs in the women's section that we can bring out?
What can we do? Get some chairs from the back?
Okay, this is good. It's a good problem to have.
Would you like some chairs over here, or would you like to sit there?
All right. Fantastic. There's an extra chair near me as well. You know, no one wants to be in the hot seat. Yeah.
Oh.
Michael, do you want to?
Richard.
Okay.
Richard, push the screen.
Yeah, you can do that too.
Push the screen.
Okay. So as we're continuing to go on, and if someone would just mind sharing a source with Rachel and with Steve, great to see you guys. No, it's all good. Glad you're here. By the time you get to Vayikra, by the time you get to the Jews in the desert, there's many more specific dietary laws that have been added. Right? In the times of the Torah itself, we have prohibitions of what animals are considered pure and impure. We have the prohibition of milk and meat, or at least do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. We have prohibitions against eating bugs, eating almost every kind of insects, with the possible exceptions of grasshoppers. We can talk about that another time. If you're a Jew of Yemenite descent, enjoy all the grasshoppers you want. Or actually, not all of them. You know specifically which ones you can eat and don't eat. But by the time we get to the Torah, what I thought was really interesting, if you look at source 4, is that the framing of what animals you can and cannot eat is not just about what kind of person this makes you into. There seems to be a specific intent in these verses. So could someone read... I guess we'll go.
Okay.
We'll go chronologically, or we'll go clockwise. Joan, could you read source 4, which is in Vayikra?
So you shall set apart the clean beast from the unclean bird from the clean. You shall not draw abomination upon yourselves through beast or bird or anything with which the ground is alive, which I have set apart for you to treat as unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from other peoples to be mine.
Okay. So if I asked you to take these verses in Vayikra and Leviticus and tell me, what's the purpose of refraining from some animals? From refraining from the unclean or the tummy animals? What would you take out of these verses as like a reason behind them?
To be holy.
To be holy. So you should be holy to God. How does the holiness manifest itself in these verses? Because there's a, you should be holy because I, God, am holy, and then there's something else.
I'm making a distinction?
Yeah.
I mean, if everything is edible...
Yeah.
If everything's edible, you can eat mindlessly.
Okay, if everything's edible, you can eat mindlessly. The distinction here... you can see? Okay. Here, I'm still looking at it. Friend, if you want to just come, you can complete the circle. Just come back here. Yeah. You can share sources with Michael. Perfect. So,
Maimonides say that what you eat, it has to
do
with your spirituality.
Great. We'll get to that in a second. Before we get to like the medieval philosophers and what they think about kosher versus non-kosher, I think there's something here that we can't ignore, and this is something that's going to be picked up a lot in the rabbinic comments from later, is by keeping kosher, you're creating a distinction between the Jewish people and other peoples. Right, that's the end of this verse. Right, you shall be holy to me, for I the Lord am holy. I have set you apart from the other peoples to be mine. So your dietary laws are going to be a mark of... Richard, you use the word distinct. right? Distinction is actually, there's a Jewish people that eats differently than other peoples. A friend of mine pointed out to me, and I haven't seen this myself, but apparently in archaeological studies of the land of Israel, there are no pig bones that have been found. No pig bones have been found in, like, if you dig down, at least to the appropriate layers of the land of Israel. So there's a kind of distinctiveness, even in the history of the land, between how Jews eat, how Jews used to eat.
So this might mean there were no pigs in
there. Okay, I'm not an archaeologist. That's more of a paleontologist.
But you probably don't see any giraffe bones there either.
That's a good point. Okay. I thought that was anecdotally interesting.
Yeah.
I make no claim on the historicity of it. What I think is interesting, though, is when you get to the philosophy, why does this all matter? So what I remember from Rambam, from Maimonides and his Guide of the Perplexed, is he actually says, what's the purpose of all these kosher laws? It keeps you healthy. Maimonides says that. So Rambam is an Aristotelian. He also has kind of a utilitarian view of a lot of the commandments, that they're there to make your life better on some level. And so a lot of what Rambam does in his Guide of the Perplexed is try to justify laws that he felt to be binding based on like the science of his day. Okay, that's one idea. Rabbi Samson of Hirsch takes a very different approach. And we'll just read a few lines of it. Sheldon, would you start us? Just, why don't you read the first four lines?
God did not regulate your eating by these laws in order that you do not sicken physically. His word itself explains their meaning to you. If you have eaten forbidden food and absorbed it into your system, you may be more nourished and better fed, but the animal instinct will be aroused more strongly within you, and your body becomes more blunted as an instrument of the spirit. Your moral personality is now faced with a fiercer battle and is less equipped for the fight against evil.
Yeah. Why don't you pass there? Thank you. So it's powerful. So I wasn't sure what to make of this comment of Hirsch in Horeb. That's his kind of philosophy of the commandments. It seems that, to me, he's saying one of two things. Either that there's some kind of metaphysical power to eating kosher food that is different, that's not physical in nature, but it's metaphysical. Or maybe you could read it a little bit more broadly as when a person learns to place limits upon themselves, they create a certain kind of inner strength, and that inner strength allows them to focus more on spirituality as opposed to their physical temptations. I know I always have like a loss when I go back to New York because there's a lot more kosher food there for those who spent some time, and it's always like my descent back into gluttony happens when I go to New York, and like all of my diet rules kind of just go out the wayside. I think I had pizza three times in my first 2 days there. Yeah, Jonah.
Yeah, just to interject, I've heard Indian people from India who are vegetarian basically say the same thing. They feel like not eating meat will kind of make them less angry, and
so that's more of like the metaphysical argument, like you are what you eat on a.
Or yeah, if you eat animals, you may kind of be angry or like not as nice, but if you don't, you'll have kind of those higher.
It's connected to the idea of memory, and that being stored in the cells.
Yeah.
And so if you're consuming some being that was murdered, you're consuming that.
And you're taking that in.
It's a genetic memory too that they just kind of demonstrated, right?
Uh huh.
That people have generational memory.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I quoted that article. Yeah.
There's another aspect. If your food is different from the other food, whoever the others are, you're not going to eat with that person because you share a different lifestyle. If you don't eat with them, then you don't get too close to them and you don't intermarry.
Okay. So this is a perfect segue for the rest of tonight's class. And
you show them.
Yeah, you got it, Tiffany. So there are probably many reasons for why. There's certainly been many reasons written for why kosher is an important set of mitzvot of laws. But what we're now going to kind of segue into is not the Torah's laws of kosher, but a set of rabbinic laws that have been added onto them later. And I'm not going to tell you when they were written just yet. We'll figure that out by parsing through the sources themselves. And I mentioned what they're called before. They're called Ma'achalei Akum, or food that has some connection to Gentiles that should be avoided. So already in the Torah, you see this kind of something about particularism in the laws of kosher. So now let's talk a little bit for a minute, and then we'll go into the sources. How do rabbis create laws? it's a broad question. I don't expect any one person to have an answer. But this is, there's a whole area of study about this. You know, the rabbis do a few things with mitzvot. One is that they interpret the Torah's laws. But in addition, they often, not always, not so often, but on occasion, they would add rabbinic commandments. We call those gzerot, edicts. Sometimes it's the expression that we quote from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, from Shammai. And parenthetically, Shammai is a name to remember because we'll get to him later. Shammai is the great battle, or the great co-conspirator, that's not the right word, opposer?
Antagonist.
Opponent, thank you, all good words. This is me on my early morning schedule, of Hillel. And Shammai has a famous phrase, Asu Siag LaTorah, build a fence around the Torah. So there's going to be these Torah laws, and you should create additional fences to protect the original laws of the Torah itself. And the expression that's used about how the rabbis create laws is that Ke'en De'oraita Tiknun, that they made laws in the form of Torah laws. They're going to borrow constructs that already existed in the Torah itself. They're going to, an example of this, you may not think of it this way, I think Rabbi Fox once shared this in a drash, Hanukkah is based on a Torah construct. What holiday is Hanukkah modeled after?
Sukkot.
It's Sukkot. Oh. So I think it's mostly Sukkot. It's the only holiday with 8 days. That's the only holiday with 8 days. Shammai's opinion specifically is that you should light, starting with 8 candles and go down to 1. And the opinion in the Talmud there is because the offerings of Sukkot started with, I think, 13 and descended down all the way to 1 as well. So Shammai says, I'm trying to create this new rabbinic holiday of Hanukkah that didn't exist before. Well, I'm going to borrow some old precedent in the Torah, and that's going to be the holiday of Sukkot. So that's what the rabbis did. But how far do they go when they're modeling or creating new laws based on old models? And here's where kind of the debate starts. There's two opinions that are offered two different opinions as to why rabbis would have extended the original laws of kosher to all of these details, and we'll get into them now, about not eating bread cooked by non-Jews, not eating cooked dishes by non-Jews, not having cheese of non-Jews, not having milk of non-Jews, not having wine of non-Jews. Right? These are some of the popular ones. I think it covers almost all of them. What were they basing it on? So one thought is, this is based on a legitimate kosher concern, that only Jews really know the laws of kashrut well. And if you don't know the laws of kashrut well, if you don't know the laws of kosher, then how can you keep kosher? And even if I say, oh, this is only made of something that this has no lard in it, well, maybe we're a little concerned and we want to be extra careful. So when the rabbis are instituting these new kind of on top of the original law, kosher laws, are they calling them extensions of kashrut? Or are they calling them something else entirely? Maybe it has nothing to do with kosher. Maybe it has nothing to do with what food you're actually putting in your mouth. But as Sippy says, it has a lot to do with particularism. It has a lot to do with maintaining kind of a Jewish people that's distinct from everyone else. And as we're going to go through these sources, we're actually going to find that in the Talmud itself, some of these laws fall into one category, and some of these laws fall into the other. And why does it matter what category they fall into? Because if you're following the laws of kosher, then you take on all the stringencies of kosher law. For example, what happens if I have a meat pot and I accidentally drop in a cup of milk and then I boil it? What do I have to do with the pot?
I have a question for you.
If it's non-kosher food, if I'm creating laws based on the precedent of kosher, then the pot has become non-kosher and I have to make it kosher. But if it has nothing to do with kosher and it's just some separate kind of set of laws that are about creating a sense of distinctiveness in the Jewish people, then it doesn't really matter if it transferred taste, because it wasn't a kashrut law to start with. Mm-hmm. So based on the nafka mina here, the practical difference of what system they're using or what kind of setup they're using, is if it's about kosher, then we were going to make you kosher the utensils if you put in something that was, let's say, cooked by a non-Jew. But if it's about peoplehood and distinctiveness or particularism, then it doesn't really matter if it got cooked in. You shouldn't eat it, but after the fact, it doesn't affect the dishes. Another way to frame this is this an obligation on the item itself, right? Such that if you treat the item as non-kosher, then you may have to make the pot kosher after. Or is it a mitzvah on the individual, right? You as an individual should create a sense of particularism, but it doesn't really affect the items that you're cooking in.
Yeah.
Or, so that's phrased as, is it something about the chafetz or the chefza, the item? Or is it something about the gavra, the individual, the person? Gavra is the Aramaic of gever, which means a man. Or is it about the personhood or about the item? If you didn't get that, it's totally fine. We'll leave it on the side and move into one of the kind of collection of these mitzvot in source 6. So who's up for reading?
Okay, so these are the items of non-Jews that are prohibited, yet their prohibition is not against deriving benefit from them. Milk that was milked by a non-Jew without a Jew watching, and their bread and their oil, although Rabbi and his court permitted their oil, and stewed vegetables.
And it goes on, but I cut out the rest of it. So let's just parse this before we move on to the next page. These are items that are prohibited, but you can derive benefit from them. What's an example of deriving benefit that is permitted here?
If you have it, you can sell them to someone else.
If you have it, you can sell it and benefit from the money of the sale, or from the profit from the sale. Okay, great. So we've seen milk.
But you can't sell milk that was from a cow that was milked on Shabbos.
Okay, so we're not even going to enter into Shabbos stuff today.
Okay,
we're not going to get into Shabbos.
There's certain things you can't benefit.
Well, parenthetical, a similar discussion to what we're having now is if something is, let's say, cooked on Shabbat improperly, is that a kosher prohibition or is it a separate prohibition? And the nafka mina, the difference here is, if you cook something on Shabbat, do you then have to kosher your pot afterwards? So it's a discussion. We generally, there's room for leniency and we'll get there another time. Okay, so we now have a list of items. The one that did not make it onto this list is cheese, but the very next Mishnah talks about cheese. And the same Mishnayot here talk about wine as well. So we're going to try to cover all of them in the 28 minutes we have left and kind of create this beautiful thesis that I've been working on, if possible. Okay, so let's move into these. What is non-Jewish food and why is it prohibited? I really encourage you to read these laws later, to read these sources later for yourselves. I'm going to summarize because otherwise we're going to get caught in the details of source 7. So source 7... before I get here, every source I think today that I'm quoting from Mishnah or Talmud are all from the tractate of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah means foreign worship. So what does foreign worship mean in a Jewish context? It means worship of idols. Foreign worship means different forms of let's say, paganism and not monotheistic worship. So this tractate that discusses what to do with idols that you find in your house, that you're given as a present, etc., goes on a kind of tangent and says, well, what are the relationships, or how does halacha govern the relationship between idolaters and Jews? And by extension, even if someone's not strictly an idolater, but between someone who's Jewish and someone who's not Jewish. So that's kind of the theme of the tractate that brings it together. So when the Talmud's talking about, we're starting with chalav akum. The Talmud is going to talk about milk. And the Talmud emphatically says, and you can read this source longer for yourself, is milk that is milked by someone who's non-Jewish a concern about keeping your Jewish people together and not mixing in by, I don't know, fraternizing over milk? Or is it a concern of kosher? And the conclusion that the Talmud says, it gives two different interpretations, but it says either way you look at it, it's a concern of kashrut. We are concerned that there are non-kosher animals that also have milk. And maybe if you're buying milk from a non-Jew, they're going to be mixing in cow milk with camel milk. This is an example. So the Talmud asks questions. There's an assumption in the Gemara that the only kinds of milk that can be turned into cheese are kosher milks, that you can't turn non-kosher milk into cheese. I've never tried to make camel milk. If you ever tried it, let me know. But that's the Talmud's assumption. And so they say, we have a good idea here. We can test all the milk before we drink it. Let's just try to curd the milk when you first get it. And the Talmud's answer is, even kosher milk will leave a little bit of whey at the end, so you can't tell for sure if it's kosher, if it's non-kosher. Therefore, unless if it's been milked by a Jew or supervised by a Jew when being milked, you should not drink milk from non-Jewish farmers. Okay. The Ramah, just to look at source 8, what does he say about vessels of the non-Jew? Because this is going to kind of put us in one camp or the other. So who wants to read source 8 for me? This is a shorter source.
No, but the non-Jew makes vessels non-kosher when they are cooked in them, just as any prohibited food, even though it is only an uncertainty whether he is mixed in something non-kosher, and so too with non-Jewish cheese.
Okay, and cheese is our next topic. So if I asked you now to kind of take this Rama, Rama is Rabbi Moshe Israelis. He lived in the 1500s, and he wrote the Ashkenaz gloss to the Code of Jewish Law from Rabbi Yosef Cairo. So he's considered a very authoritative source. Is he putting milk in the category of this might be non-kosher? Sorry, this might be non-kosher. I'm going to try to keep my same hands. Or is he putting it in the category of you have to be careful about eating some things lest you come to fraternize or intermingle a little bit too much? Which category is this going in? In the latter. The former. He's saying it's a concern, it's an uncertainty whether something non-kosher made it in, right? Don't buy even, you know, the labeled cow milk because maybe there's some camel milk in it and that's not kosher. And therefore, because it's a kosher concern, what does it do to the pots and pans that it's cooked in? Even though on a Torah level, it's only a doubt. The rabbis created this rabbinic non-kosher status and said, therefore, you have to make the pot kosher afterwards. Okay, so when it comes to milk, the reasoning is a doubt. Maybe it's not kosher. And the rabbis created a fence around it. So I mentioned to you that what puzzled me about all these laws is that for every single one of these rabbinic stringencies, the rabbis themselves created a loophole out of it. So already in the medieval period, you have rabbis saying, what if you live in a country that has no camels, where the only milk that's being sold is milk from kosher animals? Does this gzera, does this rabbinic edict still apply, or does it fall apart? So that's kind of the leniency that starts to be talked about in the 1300s. Yes, Steve? Okay. So there's two sides, like every Jewish question, on the two different opinions. But the opinion that gets picked up 700 years later by a famous rabbi named Moshe Feinstein is that it's really a question of mitziut, of the reality on the ground. If you can ascertain with absolute confidence that whatever milk is being provided to you has no chance of having any non-kosher milk in it, and nothing's been mixed in, then you can eat, you can drink the milk without any questions. It's fully considered kosher. That's what Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says. Anyone know the reasoning? I don't know about you. I drink milk off the shelf, even if it doesn't have a kosher symbol. I eat to the extent that I eat dairy chocolate, I have my Hershey bars, and I don't check to make sure that the milk in the Hershey bar has been, as long as it has a kosher symbol, I don't make sure that the milk is from a Jewish milked cow. So where's this, what's the logic here? Yeah, Tibby?
As I understand it, milk is so supervised in this country by governmental agencies, and then they're so strict about what goes into it that rabbinic supervision is not required.
So that's exactly, that's the leniency of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, which is not accepted in many parts of the Orthodox community. Chalav Yisrael, which is not, you know, we often think of it as a stringency. It's not a stringency. It's actually the explicit law in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law. For those communities, most modern Orthodox communities are lenient to say that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, to rely on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who said the FDA is so careful about milk producers, and they monitor all the levels. I think they do testing on the milk to make sure, Claire, you're the expert about all the scientific stuff, I'll leave it to you, to make sure that it's all kind of, quote, kosher in the non-halachic sense, and there's been no other animal products mixed in, that we rely, at least on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in our community, that you don't need a kosher symbol on milk.
So in Eastern Europe, if you went to Eastern Europe, you would still have the same stringencies applied.
So some people are lenient in Eastern Europe also, but I personally would, I check country by country. So I know England is okay, Italy is okay, France I believe is okay. Different countries have different standards, and it really just depends on where you go. And there are experts who look into this stuff, and I just call them. If you want, I'm always happy to call on your behalf as well. Okay, so milk goes into there was a rabbinic edict created lest it might actually have some non-kosher food in it. Therefore, if you can find with certainty proof that there's nothing non-kosher, there's room to say, loophole number one, that the prohibition falls to the wayside. Okay, let's move on very quickly to cheese. Cheese is complicated. I did a whole Shabbat U on it. The Talmud presents no fewer than six reasons as to why cheese has to be coming from a Jewish owner or Jewish supervision. You can read them for yourself in Source 9. It's a summary of all of them. But take my word for it, cheese falls into the same category as milk, according to most opinions, which is that it's a question of kashrut. However, the laws governing cheese, because it's a more complicated kind of reasoning in the Talmud itself, you can see there's six reasons, cheese laws are much more strict. I know the conservative movement relies on a similar principle about cheese, that if you can make sure that there's no non-kosher products in it, then you can eat that cheese. It's based on a minority opinion quoted by Tosfot in the 1200s about a certain town in Italy that used to use vegetarian rennet. I think the conservative movement bases their psak on that, to be lenient about all cheeses nowadays. The majority Orthodox opinion is to be stringent about cheese and to require a kosher symbol. We could get into a lot more detail later. What's the leniency? How do you make kosher cheese? For the majority of times, you know, the best kosher cheese on the market is not made by Jewish cheesemakers. So what do they do?
Animal rennet.
So even if you don't use animal rennet, it could be that the cheese is kosher even if you do use animal rennet under one circumstance, which is either Jewish supervision or Jewish involvement. The majority of kosher cheese now is made by a kosher supervisor going and putting the rennet actually into the milk itself and starting the catalyzation process of turning the milk into cheese. So Jewish involvement is kind of our way out of this one. Okay, that's not the best example. Let's move on to the other side. The rabbis forbade, in the Mishnah we already saw, pat akum. Pat is the Talmudic word for bread. So the bread of non-Jews. And there's a kind of a whole back and forth. Again, you can read Source 10 on your own later if you'd like. There's a whole back and forth. Why is pat akum non-kosher? We're just going to skip to the last three lines. Who's up in the reading? Yeah, good. Yeah, please.
What did the sages see that caused them to prohibit it? It was prohibited due to the concern that Jews might befriend Gentiles while breaking bread with them, which could lead to marriage with Gentiles.
Okay. So here's the other side. You see, like, the particularism. Jews need to stay with Jews coming back into the picture. Right? It wasn't a concern with cheese. It wasn't a concern with milk. It's becoming a concern with bread. Okay. First of all, marriage. We read the translation and took that for granted. But you know who didn't? Rambam, Maimonides. The Hebrew word there, if you want, it's the last word in the Hebrew side of that page, is chatnut, which sounds an awful lot like the Hebrew word for chatuna or marriage. Right? So that's the simple reading. I think that's Rashi's translation. Elsewhere, Rashi comments that the reason for bread is benotehem, because of the intermingling of boys and girls. Right? It can lead to mixed dancing. That's always my sorry, it's my cheesy rabbi joke of the night. All right.
Just leave out the snake poison,
we'll be fine. I'll leave out the snake poison. But look at Source 11, the next top of the next page, how Maimonides reads this Mishnah. He says, and he extends bread to just cooking the majority of things. So he puts baking bread with cooking foods together in the same category. And Hank, you're up for reading Source 11.
All of these things were prohibited in order that we should distance ourselves from them and not become mixed among them, so that we should not be led out of our expensive socializing with them to stretch forth our hand for that which is prohibited. And that is what the rabbis are referring to when they mention cotton.
Okay, so there's a few things going on in Maimonides' commentary here. One is he translates cotton differently. He doesn't translate chatnut in the literal sense of marriage, but just in the kind of broader sense of bonding, of like becoming kind of connected together.
Too
friendly. But his main concern is not marriage. His main concern is, if you become too friendly, first you're eating kosher food at someone's house, and then later you're going to, I think his language is, to stretch your hand to that which is prohibited. You start with chicken soup, and you end with pork. Kind of that's a little bit of what the Rambam's getting at here. So even though the simple reading of the Talmud, why is bread prohibited? Because it may lead to intermarriage on some level. The Rambam is actually extending it and says it's not specific to marriage. It's more about what your commitment to the mitzvah, to the obligations of the Torah, might become diluted as you kind of fraternize or socialize a little bit beyond the Jewish people itself. Okay. So, yeah.
And concisely, what does the term prohibited mean?
What is... Yeah, so the Hebrew in prohibited...
in terms of this discussion, prohibited means...
It sounds like he's talking about, I mean, any kind of prohibition. Examples of that would be Shabbat, desecrating Shabbat, not eating non-kosher food. He's not specifically talking about a prohibition of a Jewish person marrying a non-Jewish person. That exists too, but that's not what he's specifically talking about here. So he's kind of widening the definition of what katnut means. Okay. But the majority opinion here, whether you take the Rambam's reading of it or not, is that bread has more to do with fraternization. And so because that's the concern, here's the loopholes that become accepted. They're mentioned as possibilities in the Talmud, and then they're accepted as normative, certainly in Ashkenaz halacha, at least after the fact in Sephardic halacha as well. It's actually a debate between Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch for Sephardic Jews, and Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who wrote the commentary for Ashkenaz Jews. So leniency number one is if it's baked in a bakery. That's the halachic leniency here is pat palter. Palter means a professional baker. Why does that make a difference? Why should bread baked in someone's kitchen be prohibited, but bread baked in someone's, I don't know, at someone's shop be...
Strictly a business relationship, you're less likely to bond with them on a personal level?
Yeah, so that's exactly it. If it's baked in a professional setting, you're not going to have the same level of like socialization as come over to my house, we'll break bread together. It's a little bit lower of an issue. Mm-hmm. Similarly, there's another leniency that doesn't quite make it as far in Shulchan Aruch, that if you buy bread on the side of the road, that might be okay. If you're traveling between cities, it's okay. If you're in your hometown, more of a problem. Why? Because if you go to your favorite coffee shop and you get the same kind of baked good for the morning every day, that creates a relationship, as opposed to if you're just kind of going passing through town. That might be less of a concern. Here's what I kind of wanted to dig at. Yeah. Richard, and then going into leniency leniency number two. Yeah.
I'll say, if they haven't pulled challah from the bread, can you still eat it?
So if they haven't pulled challah from the bread, can you still eat it? So that's, Richard's referring to the Torah obligation that when you bake a significant amount of bread, you should save a portion of it for the priest, for the Kohen. So that that obligation is still kept nowadays. Problem is, we don't know exactly who the Kohanim are. Right, because even if someone gets called up for the Kohen Aliyah, you don't necessarily know with absolute certainty that they're still a Kohen. So what do? We take a little piece of the challah, we make a blessing on it, because it's a rabbinic obligation even without a temple, and we just let it burn in the side of an oven. So Richard's point is, well, maybe this is more of an issue of like other laws not being kept. Only a Jew is obligated in taking separating challah. So if it's being baked by a non-Jew, then it doesn't apply on a strict Torah level. Okay, the other leniency, and this is the one that I think kind of opened up my whole questions about loopholes. This is where the loophole thing really started for me. If there's a Jew involved in the baking, and when we get to cooking, we'll see if there's a Jew involved in the cooking, then it becomes okay. And I just what physical change is there between Jew versus non-Jew involved in this baking, especially when you read the Talmud's framing of it in Source 12. And this is again in Avodah Zarah, we're just going from one part of the tractate within like a 3-page range. We're basically going from one part to another. So we're in Source 12 now, and who's up for reading? Robin, do you want to take it?
Ravina says, the halakha is that this bread baked in an oven that a Gentile licked and a Jew subsequently baked, or alternatively, if a Jew lit the oven and a Gentile baked, or alternatively, even if a Gentile lit and a Gentile baked, and a Jew came and stoked the coals to heat the fire, it is permitted as the act of the Jew speeds up the baking process.
Okay. So, Claire, you have a question?
It just baffles me too. To me, I feel like, before you were just eating together, now you're partaking in the baking process together. Doesn't that lead to more bonding?
More bonding, I hear you. Right. I mean, I feel like there's like the luxury of like cooking in a modern era where it's like something that we actually enjoy doing as opposed to something we do like begrudgingly in like a hot outdoor furnace situation? Maybe. I hear that point. I never thought of that before. What kind of got me about this is like, okay, I understand. Well, actually, there's a lot to get here. What's going on? Like, why, if I could either go first early in the morning and light the fire for the oven that's going to stay lit for the rest of the day, which happens to be what a lot of restaurants do that are so supervised, that there you'll have a mashgiach, a supervisor, go in the morning and they'll light the flame, and then the non-Jewish staff will do all the cooking for the day. Or you can have a non-Jewish person turn on the flame as long as a Jew comes in and actually puts in the bread, right? So that's a great question. The assumption here is that it's 100% kosher ingredients. Everything is kosher. On top of that, we're saying there's still a prohibition, possibly, of non-Jewish bread.
So you're expecting this Gentile to know what to put in and what not to put into the bread.
Yes. Which wasn't such a big issue in some parts of world history when bread was made of water and flour.
Or milk in the bread.
Or snake oil.
Or snake oil. Well, snake oil is only an issue with cheese. No, I'm joking. Where this does become an issue is in France. Early on in French, I'm not an expert about cooking, but my understanding is that French baking involves a lot of lard. And a lot of lard, I could be wrong. And a lot of kind of assumptions that existed about kashrut laws when Jews started kind of becoming more sensitive and familiar with French baking techniques, they actually became much more strict in some areas in a counter response to how bread was being baked. So that's for a separate time. They're basically saying, well, even if you can just go to a bakery, right, which is not like a close relationship, and buy bread, you can't do that in some parts of Europe. And you start to see Poskim saying this in the 15 and 16 and 1700s. We can no longer rely on these leniencies because now we don't know about the ingredients anymore. Doesn't get picked up everywhere. Yeah, Kirsten? And then I'm going to start moving a little more quickly.
So, I'm not sure when Ravina lived, but...
Ravina is a later Amora, if I'm not mistaken. So, 400 or 500s.
Certainly, common era. One of the things I saw when I was traipsing through the Italian mountains is there was this oven. It was an outdoor oven, and it appeared like all of the families that lived in this era used the same oven.
Mm-hmm.
So that it makes sense then that you have Gentiles who maybe lit, and then a Jewish person would come and bake in that oven, and then somebody else would come and bake it.
So you're saying historically this kind of setup makes sense?
Yes, at least in certain parts.
Great.
Because in small communities, there might not be that many ovens going.
Yeah.
Certainly not in everybody's.
My grandmother told me that back in the day in Europe, when she grew up in White Russia, all the Jews in the town would go to the local, I think, non-Jewish bakers, and they would all bring their chillin pots before Shabbos and put it in the big communal oven. And then the reason that Erevs became popular for people to carry Erevs, those boundaries, was so that you could take the chillin pot from the bakery back to your house on Shabbat morning. So anyways, that's I've heard of this idea of a communal oven. Just zooming back into the source 12 in the Talmud, so what's the meaning of these, what seems like ritualistic actions? The bread's going to bake whether you stoke the coals or not. The stoking the coals is the one that should get to you. Come on, does this really have an impact? And if that doesn't get to you, read how Rambam interprets it. He first says, either you can light the oven or put in the bread or soak the coals. And then Rambam in verse 13, Claire, I think it's your turn.
Even if no one throws a small flake into the fire, the bread is permitted. As the reason for this is so that there should be a sign, pecker, that their bread is prohibited.
Okay. So in the Rambam's leniency here, I think you start to get a little bit as to what the rabbis are trying to get to. The Rambam throws at the wildest leniency about bread, and we parenthetically, Ashkenaz Jews as opposed to Sephardic Jews, sorry, Rachel, you're out of luck, you're of Egyptian descent, right? So the Sephardim don't rely on this as much, even though it's from Maimonides, okay, for another time, at least when it comes to cooked food as opposed to bread. You have, all you have to do to make this bread considered Jewish bread is take a match halfway through the baking and just throw it in the oven. Like a tiny match, a tiny piece of wood. So it's clear that this is not about mitziyut. And the Rambam says it explicitly. It's not about the reality of who's baking the bread. What's the word in Hebrew that the Rambam uses? The word in, you know, is heker, a recognition, a sign. Is that there should be some kind of sign when you're engaging in this form of eating. Almost it's like a little reminder. It's like a little poke on the shoulder, right? I can eat my bread or I can bake my bread with whomever I want, right? As long as there's something that reminds me when it's being baked among non-Jews that this is a different kind of situation than when it's being baked among Jews alone. So here's where the particularistic thing comes up again, right? It's not a matter about the kosher when it comes to bread. And similarly, most of us assume when it comes to cooking foods as well, because cooked dishes, many cooked dishes have these laws as well. It's not about what the ingredients are. The ingredients have to be kosher. If they're not kosher, we're not even starting this conversation. But beyond that, it's about, you know, am I remembering as I'm eating among non-Jews that this is a different experience than when I eat with Jews alone? That's the heker idea. There's just some sign of recognition or recognition in what I'm doing. Yeah.
It's a obviously symbolic.
This is totally a symbolic gesture, right? It has nothing to do with the actual quality of the bread. Exactly. Just to get...
reminding you that you're eating with non-Jews?
Yeah.
It's like a reminder of the distinct identity.
Yeah, it's a reminder of the distinct identity. There's something I have to do when I'm eating in a more broad setting that I don't have to do when it's just kind of the Jewish people, when it's just Jew among Jew. And there's a sense of distinctiveness or particularism that's being created there. Okay. Yeah, Steve. Like, just because I know I want to be sensitive to everyone's time, so I'm going to try to run through the rest of this as quickly as possible. When it comes to bishul akum, this is cooking in non-Jewish dishes. The same leniency of throwing in a match, throwing in a little piece of wood, applies as well. On top of that, so that's number. If you're underneath source 14 now, it's the corresponding leniency. Number one, there's the Jewish involvement. Turn on the oven. Put the food in. Like then throw in a match halfway through, but there's two others as well. One is if the food that is being cooked is food that is otherwise edible raw. If you're cooking carrots, but you can eat carrots raw, then there's no prohibition of bishul akum of Gentile cooking. Similarly, if the food that's being cooked, without getting into the details, this is much more complicated, is eino ola al shulchan malachim, is not fit for a king's table. Which is kind of Talmudic parlance for is not like really fancy food. If it's like fast food as opposed to like, I don't know, pick your favorite restaurant, whatever, as opposed to fancy food, or that the way that Rav Soloveitchik, I think, used to describe it, if it's the kind of food that wouldn't be cooked, that wouldn't be served at the president's gala dinner, right, then it's not subject to these prohibitions. And so, like, all of this together kind of just got at me, like, what's the point of all of this? Either say it's forbidden or say it's permitted, but, like, why are we crossing our hands in opposite directions to say, like, well, you shouldn't do it unless if it goes this way? And to take it a step further, and this is where we're going to get into a tiny bit of history, Stam Yenam is probably the most famous of these. This is starting with source 15. Stam Yenam, I translated as non-Jewish wine, literally means, what does Stam mean in Hebrew? Stam means, like, meh, normal. Stam means normal wine, which is, it's not wine that's used as a libation in a temple, right? Because that is biblically prohibited as benefiting from idol worship. And it's not wine produced by Jews that is, let's say, fully kosher for our assumptions now. It's wine halfway down the middle. It's not prohibited by the Torah, but it's not Jewish wine. And the rabbi said it should be forbidden too. And if you want to look at the end of source 15, which is what I'm a little bit less interested in now, it's very clear there that the prohibition is, even though nowadays most wine is not drunk in a, let's say, polytheistic setting for the sake of worship, the rabbis extended a prohibition about it lest you come to intermingle over the course of wine, Jew and Gentile, Jew and non-Jew together. Okay, let's just read source 15 with kind of an eye towards history right now. I'm going to read this one because I just want to make sure we get through it. Okay, so 15. Bale says that Avimi of Nota said in the name of Rav, these are all Amorayim, they're writing, if, let's say, around 300 of the Common Era, maybe 400. The prohibitions with regards to Gentiles' bread and their oil. If you don't remember, we nixed the one about oil. That's no longer on the list, already in the first Mishnah. But fine, at least about bread. Their wine and their daughters. Daughters here is actually not about marrying non-Jewish women. It's a separate thing. are all from the 18 matters. The Hebrew here, so all of these are included in the Shmona Asar Davar, the 18 things. So I'm going to press pause before we keep reading. What are these 18 matters? Okay, this is where we're going to get into a bit of Jewish history. There were the famous houses in the before the turning of the millennia, before the year zero. There was the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, right? And whose opinion normally got codified as law? Hillel. Why was Hillel's opinion always codified as law? Or the house of Hillel after Hillel died, which is basically his Beit Midrash, his study hall of students that continued for centuries afterwards. Why does Hillel's opinion become codified?
A little more law.
Okay, so there's a few different reasons given. One is that they were kinder people, they were friendlier, they were a little more forgiving. Because they were more forgiving, they had more students. And because they had more students, the general principle in Talmud is majority rules. Right? It's actually not a Talmudic principle, it's a biblical principle. Acharei Rabbim L'Hatzad, you should follow the majority. Okay, so almost every debate in the Talmud and Mishnah between the houses of Hillel and Shammai, we follow the opinion of Hillel, with 18 exceptions. And that's the matter of the 18. One day, in the first century BCE, right before the turn of the millennia, there was a day in the historical context might have involved some like gangs of non-rabbinic Jews kicking out Hillel's students from the Beit Midrash. But something happened where for one day, the majority of the students in the Beit Midrash, when they were deciding the laws, were Shammai's followers. And on that one day that Shammai's followers were in charge because they had the majority, because parenthetically there were students of Hillel being beaten and killed outside of the Beit Midrash, but for another time, on that one day, they decreed 18 laws following the stringent opinion of Beit Hillel. And among those laws were?
Beit Shammai,
thank you. Among those laws were cooking and baking of Gentiles, wine of Gentiles. And then when the Talmud's trying to understand this, it says, like, what's going on here?
What does daughters have to do? I don't understand.
So their daughters is more, it's the status of ritual purity and impurity of Nida. That's one possibility. You'll see that Rabbi Steinsaltz, I'm quoting his translation, has a different one. So just read for me from the fourth line on from Rather. So this is kind of, from there. Rather, on that one day in the first century BCE, the house of Shammai was in charge. They issued a decree prohibiting their bread and their oil due to their wine. So the wine's off the limits already, so therefore don't have their bread as well, lest you forget about it and come to drink their wine. And what's the reason of the wine? They issued the decree prohibiting their wine due to the fact that this leads to familiarity and Jews will come to marry their daughters. So Rabbi Steinsaltz's opinion is the whole prohibition of wine to start with is an intermarriage, intermingling issue. And they issued a decree prohibiting their daughters due to something else. And davar acher is euphemistic for something else is euphemistic for idol worship. So because there's a concern about idol worship, therefore the wine becomes prohibited. And because we don't want you to forget about the wine, we're going to make the bread prohibited as well. And so it's kind of this widening of the prohibitions. What's going on at this era in Jewish history?
Which era?
So the first century BCE.
Concerned about intermarriage?
What's leading to the concern about intermarriage?
The Roman temple?
Jesus.
So Jesus isn't alive yet. That's going to happen 100 years later. And that's certainly...
The Roman conquest.
So that's the century when the Romans conquered Israel. And it's the first... Not the first time. It's actually the second time. It's an era in Jewish history where Jews are living in their land but are being controlled by non-Jews. Right? And we already know that there's a tremendous amount of Hellenization that's taking place in the 100 years prior to that, of Jews kind of assimilating into the greater Greek culture and later into the greater Roman culture. There are laws prohibiting Jews from practicing mitzvot, right? Kind of trying. Hanukkah happens, I think, about 100 years earlier, but I could be wrong, around that time, because it's Hanukkah's during the Greek period, which is a little bit earlier. So it's a time where specifically the students of Shammai are particularly concerned, but everyone's concerned, when Jews are no longer living on their own in the land of Israel and they're being controlled by another empire, are they going to lose their distinctiveness? And so it's specifically in that period where the rabbis are taking those old-time biblical laws, right, of basic kashrut, let's old-time kashrut, and they're saying we now need to build on that and create kind of added siyagin, and added fences to protect the intent of the laws. And part of the intent of the laws is to retain Jewish distinctiveness. So here's where I'm going to kind of get into my thesis, and I'll leave you for the night. Dr. Alana Steinhain came as a scholar in residence last year, and her Shabbat Yu just like left me blown away. I quoted the title of her Shabbat Yu because it's a great title. What kind of God wants loopholes? Romans, rabbis, and rationalizations. And she was talking about other kinds of loopholes, because she was actually talking about loopholes where the rabbis found ways out of biblical laws. But here I wanted to just talk for a minute about the rabbis creating loopholes within their own rabbinic laws, because we've spoken about a number of them. So here's where I think something, this is what I'm trying to develop, and I'm curious to hear your feedback because it's my first time sharing this in public. I think the Chazal, the rabbis of the Talmud, and specifically the Mishnah earlier, are looking back at the original laws of Kashrut, and they're realizing that some of the earliest mitzvot are universal in their nature, like Adam and Chava were given commandments about food, and that has something to do with sanctity. But then later on, that sanctity is kind of relegated, the laws of food are specific to the Jewish people, and that becomes a sign of distinctiveness. And in an era where distinctiveness was at risk, they placed on additional food prohibitions specifically to protect those distinctive attributes of the Jewish people, right? Why are they kind of permitting a loophole within all these restrictions? So I think if you take that idea from the Rambam, that it's not about what you eat or how you eat it, it's about are you conscious of the difference between eating among Jews as opposed to eating in a mixed society. Just the consciousness is the goal. So what I think the point of the loopholes are is to say I can basically get away with eating, well, sorry, that's not so easy. I can often get away with eating with whom I want, as long as in the back of my mind, there's a sense of this. There's eating among my people, and then there's eating in a more broad society, right? And I do that by putting my hand over my head, right? I do that by kind of by living a ritual that seems in its very essence to not make any sense, right? I'm going to bake the bread with my non-Jewish friends. And I'll just throw in something there. And it has nothing, it affects the taste of the bread in no way. It's just a reminder to me that this is different than when I'm just baking bread among my own people. Right? And so just to kind of take this idea of particularism and universalism, and that's what the next three classes are going to be digging into from different angles and different ways. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks probably writes this more beautifully than anyone else, that Judaism is kind of the fusion, or maybe you could even say the tension, between a deep concern for the Jewish people, for particularism, and a deep concern for the world at large, a universalism. And we live in the tension between that space, between those two poles, right? And so when we kind of take on these rabbinic laws of Bishul Akum, of the bread and the cooking and the cheese and the milk and the wine, what we're kind of doing is creating a sense of particularism that doesn't exclude us from the universalism around us as well. And I'll just finish with the quote in source 18. It limits us, but there are ways through it as long as we remember the limitations. And that's the whole point. The loopholes remind you of the original intent of the law. And so Rabbi Sacks says in source 18, the universality of moral concern is not something we learn by being universal, but by being particular. Because we know what it is to be a parent, loving our children, not children in general. We understand what it is for someone else, somewhere else, to be a parent, loving his or her children, not ours. So I think the point that Rabbi Sacks is making is, in your more confined context, as you go to the more micro level, you build a set of values and practices. And once you learn how to build it on a micro level within extending this the Jewish people, eventually you learn how to extend it to all of humanity at large as well. And personally, because I've been struggling with these mitzvot, like I'll be the first to admit it, I like people, and I don't just like Jewish people, right? And I think there's value to interacting beyond the Jewish people, and that's probably part of what makes modern Orthodox. We're not trying to create silos for ourselves, and yet we have these mitzvot that tend to silo ourselves, right? It's a given. So when I was trying to research it and look into these mitzvot, that's what I think the Chazal were getting at, is creating a construct in which we maintain our distinctiveness and our particularism. And even as we kind of find ways through it, like an example of this is coffee houses. Like, no rabbi was willing to say that it's forbidden to eat, drink coffee in a coffee house, even though on some level coffee is served at very fancy state dinners. Right? Maybe you should say it's prohibited. But no rabbi was willing to forbid coffee, even in Vienna's best coffee houses, as opposed to wine. There were actually some rabbis, but not most of them. Because I think, you know, in this very fine line between keeping our Jewish identity intact and spreading our wings to the greater world, the rabbis allowed us a way through it. And I think that's the point of the loopholes. Yashikov, thank you, everyone. I know this was complicated. Next week's a little bit simpler. It's just, what do you do if you're a Jew with Jewish laws living in a greater society with non-Jewish laws? So we'll talk about those ideas. Have a great night.
What do you do when you're talking to a vegetarian restaurant about?
So if you want to